Hey guys, and welcome to episode 256 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now firstly, thank you as always for listening, I deeply appreciate it. And in this episode, I got on Dr. Sam Greenblatt, and in it, I talked to him about what got him into working with people with OCD, his own kind of mental health journey. And in particular, in the episode, he explained some reasons why he feels sometimes therapy isn't effective for people with OCD, and also why at times exposure and response prevention therapy may not be as effective as it could be for people with OCD. He breaks down those reasons and the ways in which it can work more effectively. And in it, we discuss why some other therapies may not work for OCD, fully embracing the uncertainty of ERP, why we shouldn't white knuckle through exposures, inhibitory learning theory to explain how ERP works, why anxiety doesn't always need to go down to see improvements in ERP therapy. We talk about the backdoor spike, treating the problem and not the symptoms, being mindful of the wording we use in therapy, and much, much more. So I really enjoyed chatting with Sam. I hope you find it useful too. And without further ado, here he is. On today's show, I have Dr. Sam Greenblatt. Sam specializes in cognitive behavioral therapy for OCD and other anxiety disorders. Sam works at the Center for Cognitive Behavioral Psychotherapy in New York. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. And of course, we met last year, wasn't it? Yeah.
We met last year. Yeah, you came to the center.
Yeah, pre-COVID.
Yeah.
Back in normality. So it's good to have you here now. And as you know, I like to get people's OCD stories or therapists' therapy stories. So, you know, what got you into your work, and then what got you into specifically with OCD?
What got me into the work actually was not an attraction to OCD first. It was an attraction to exposure response prevention. I think for two reasons. One, I really like a great return on investment. And I think that there's so much evidence behind exposure response prevention, and it has such great rates of success that I was very attracted to the idea of specializing in a treatment that really provided a great bang for people's buck and had a lot of success. And also there's an energy behind working in exposure response prevention, right? You're not just sitting down on the couch and talking about somebody's difficulties or challenges, although that's certainly a frequent part of it. But you mix it in with maybe getting out of the office, doing things, and that type of energy to me is exciting and rewarding to participate in.
Yeah, potentially more upbeat, it sounds, for you, kind of.
Yeah, it's a little more active.
Yeah.
You can see the change so clearly, oftentimes session to session, where, you know, you have the hierarchy, you have the list of items that you could observe the client moving up in terms of taking on greater and greater challenges. And you could see in real time, the learning take place of being able to conquer those fears or establish a healthier relationship with them, which is just a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And what got you into wanting to just train generally as a therapist or psychologist?
I did an interview, or not an interview, I did an internship at Bellevue Hospital back in, it was forever ago. Maybe 15 years ago. And my supervisor there, Alan Pottinger, he was a brilliant person. He taught me this term called wounded healer. I don't know if you've heard of it. And now it sounds a little pathologizing. It sounds a little edgy, but as someone in college, I was really attracted to that term. As someone who had gone through my own struggles, I've experienced depression, anxiety, actually after specializing in OCD, because PRO, just like mostly obsessional types of OCD, is not really taught in grad school so often. It was only after specializing in OCD that I was able to look at my life and realize that I had relationship OCD for the longest period of time. So having gone through these struggles, having gone through my own therapy, having experienced firsthand the rewards that therapy had brought, and that reward being so impactful to me, then I really developed an urge to spread that to others, I would say, is what got me into it.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing. And did you do ERP at the time, or was it something else?
My therapist at the time just happened to specialize in ACTS. And I was learning ERP. At the time, I was working at Zucker Hillside Hospital, has this great OCD center run by Dr. Anthony Pinto, who's a brilliant person who specializes also in OCPD. So we kind of co-collaborated a little bit. He taught me ACTS, which has been hugely influential in my own work. And I brought in things that I was taught to implement for those with OCD, being the more exposure response prevention model, which my psychologist at the time was familiar with, but I brought in kind of suggestions or things that I wanted to try out, and we kind of co-formulated these things. And yeah, I would say that both elements were hugely helpful for me.
Wow. Yeah, no, thank you for sharing. And I think there's something in that as well around, sometimes people are working with therapists who may even be CBT therapists, but maybe haven't had that much training in ERP or that comfortable with it, and so, or even ACT. And sometimes it's like you can bring various things to your therapist, your psychologist, and ask them to go away and try and, I don't say learn it, but, you know, become right, do the right. best they can to help you, you know. And it sounds like you did that there to a point.
Yeah, I definitely had the advantage or lucky situation of being trained in it. But I know that a lot of people experience some greater struggles of wishing that their clinician was had a little more expertise in things that they're specifically struggling with.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so today we're going to talk about just why some other therapies may not be that effective for OCD. I guess my first first question is, in your experience, what are some frequent reasons why some therapies for OCD don't achieve ideal results?
I'd like to rephrase the question bit, because in fact, if I could reveal this, you and I had a brief email exchange. Yeah. This is based off of a video that I had sent that I made about why previous treatment might not have worked. And in one of those things, I talk about some ways in which talk therapy to some patients that I've worked with didn't help them achieve the goals that they were looking for at the time. I think it's less about that specific therapies don't work. I think that there's a wide range of benefits that can be yielded from different modalities. But I think it's in the implementation of these therapies, even in the implementation of exposure and response prevention, that sometimes the way in which these therapies are implemented can fall short, and then therefore not help the client reach the goals that they're looking for.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. Sure. And also for not generalizing that so-and-so therapy is bad, you know,
absolutely.
Blanket statement.
Absolutely.
Which I've seen. Yeah, I'm not even going to go down that road. But yeah. I appreciate that. So I've got a question for you then, unless you wanted to kind of continue on from that.
To answer then that kind of that revised iteration of what about therapies don't work. I have, you know, a whole list of things that I think are the most common things. I could kind of go through them,
please,
one by one. But in terms of touching briefly in terms of the talk therapy, right? I think that there's exploration behind concepts that is an active exploration. I listened to that episode, I think it was 245, about psychodynamic
contemporary psychoanalysis.
Contemporary psychoanalysis. I thought it was wonderful, and I think there's some great ideas in there. What I have frequently experienced are clients who come to me after years of being in a version of talk therapy. And I say talk therapy as distinguished from, psychoanalytic or psychodynamic, and referring to a specific type of therapy that, at least according to the patient's description, seems to consist of talking about the weekly events that occurred in their lives, and perhaps achieving some catharsis at having related that information and that stressor, but not achieving insights or specific skills to help them therefore change the situations in the long term, right? Yeah. And I think that both insight-oriented therapies and more kind of present moment skill-based kind of CBT therapies can both be really useful. But a lot of therapy out there, at least according to patients' report, seems to go on for years without the patient experiencing either of those two benefits. Mm. So I certainly see that a lot. And within a population that has OCD, a lot of us could talk ad nauseum if you asked us to about our worries and our fears. But when the cycle becomes going to therapy to talk about your worries and fears and getting reassurance and then feeling relieved from the reassurance, going back into the world, building up anxiety again and going into therapy, you can both at once have the experience that therapy is useful. I have a good association with it because every time I leave the office, I feel better because I've gotten reassured. And over the long period of time, not experience the long-term change and improvement in quality of life that you're looking for. So that's a version of that I've observed a lot. I don't know if you have thoughts or responses, or you want me to just kind of rattle off other.
Yeah, no, please do rattle off. But I've got one response.
Sure.
I agree with you. I think, and I was reading a paper by, I believe, a Scottish professor, he was a humanistic primarily therapist, psychologist, I'm not sure. But he was saying, basically doing some review of a systematic review, meta-analysis or something. And he's like, we need to do better, saying we meaning humanistic therapists.
Yes.
Creating or tailoring our therapy for anxiety disorders. We have all this evidence that it can help in these different areas, but with anxiety especially, it seems to fall short. And he was basically just putting a call out to look as humanistic therapists to look for ways to tailor that and improve it. And I imagine one of the big issues that humanistic therapists make is reassurance giving.
Sure.
And as you've just said, what the negative cycle that can then get someone in, if they're going in every week feeling slightly better because, oh, my therapist told me I'm not going to kill so-and-so, or I didn't run someone over in the car, and then it just starts again.
Exactly. Yeah. In terms of other issues that I see crop up, and the rest of these would apply specifically to patients who had previously seen therapists that they report are from a CBT kind of orientation, even some that say that their previous therapist said that they specialized in OCD. I still see some common trends as to why they're still seeking out treatment and why they still feel that their goals hasn't been met. One of the common reasons is that, and of course, there's always the chance that the their previous therapist did the exact work that I'm doing, and just hearing it a second time, could be useful. But according to a patient report, they seem to have been taught sometimes more the letter of the law when it comes to engaging in exposure response prevention, rather than the spirit of the law. So what I mean by that is, when I ask patients who have been through exposure response prevention, what did exposures look like? How did you craft exposures? A lot of times what they report is something that on the surface level would look like an exposure. I put myself, in a room with a contaminated object, or I held this object in my hands, et cetera, et cetera. But when you ask what they're doing internally, a lot of times it seems like that they were unaware of instructions such as don't compulse, mentally, right? A lot of folks have the impression, it seems to me, that exposure response prevention is kind of getting through something. And if you're able to just get through the experience, the distress will naturally go down, right? There's big leaning on habituation, which is maybe the next point that I'll touch on more in depth. But that just surviving the experience.
That kind of, like white knuckling comes to mind.
Yes, I think that's a great term for it. White knuckling through it, telling yourself, this is just my OCD. Don't worry, everything's going to be fine. My clinician wouldn't have told me to do this if he didn't think that it was safe. Not fully embracing the uncertainty that we're looking to build up our ability to embrace, but rather doing behaviorally what an outside observer might see is exposure. And of course, by doing that, we rob ourselves the opportunity to build up those skills. In fact, you could make life a little more difficult for yourself, because you could have such an awful time doing these exposures and investing so much time and energy into tolerating this distress, just not in a way that is as adaptive or useful, that it could kind of scare you off from the treatment or make you more resistant to not compulsing.
Yes.
In terms of the habituation kind of element that I touched on, this represents a shift, I would say, maybe in the last 20 years or so, within OCD literature explaining why exposure response prevention happens, or why exposure and response prevention is effective. So like so many things in psychology or psychiatry, sometimes an intervention is established and it's found to be effective, or a medicine is created and it's found to be effective, but we don't really know why. It's like the egg before the chicken, or the chicken before the egg. So at first, to my knowledge, exposure response prevention was generally posited to be effective because of habituation, right? You're exposed to a stimulus, and if you expose yourself to that stimulus enough times, as long as you're tolerating it skillfully, really letting yourself deal with it, the intensity of the anxiety goes down. Maybe the intensity, the frequency, and the duration. I would say that, and so within the last few decades, psychologists have observed and then asked the question, okay, this habituation doesn't always seem to be taking place 100% of the time. Some patients are still leaving with a high frequency or intensity of intrusive thoughts, but are reporting that the quality of their life is still much better, right? The therapy still seems to be granting a lot of positive benefits. So why is that? So some more recent psychologists have posited that model of inhibitory learning, right? And inhibitory learning is learning that you can go through these experiences where your brain says there is no way you could survive this distress. It will completely overtake you. You're going to die from this, so to speak, sometimes metaphorically, sometimes literally. And just learning over and over that no matter how scary the threat the brain leverages towards you is, you can survive that experience, right? This is a lot different from certainty, right? You're not learning through doing the exposures that you are not, you know, a pedophile, or you are not, you do not have cancer or something like that. But you are learning that you can tolerate the distress, you can tolerate the uncertainty, and that's an empowering situation. Now, the reason that I think that this distinction is important, and knowing that both factors to an extent take place, is that when folks really lust after habituation and only have habituation in mind as the end goal, it can not only lead to unsatisfying results when that habituation might not completely take place, but it can also serve as a maladaptive force in therapy, where you are trying so hard to experience less distress that you're experiencing more distress, right? It becomes almost a compulsion. Is my anxiety going down? Is my distress going down? I really want it to go down. Oh my God, it's not going down. This therapy isn't working. Now it's going up, you know, and spirals and spirals. Yeah. So I think a really good understanding of both of those concepts, and having the habituation as a great dividend, a great byproduct of good therapy, but not as the main goal that you're looking for, because the inhibitory learning, learning that you can deal with anxiety or distress in no matter what form, is going to be way more consistent and way more in your control than the habituation, I think is a really important part of effective exposure response prevention.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for explaining that. I was actually going to do an entire episode on inhibitory learning. So it's good that you've covered it. I think we always say you can't control your thoughts and you can't control your feelings. And to a point, the habituation model, and not to discredit it too much, it still has its uses, but it's not perfect. And yeah, like you said, if it's not going down all the time, you just then get in that cycle of, well, what am I doing wrong? Why isn't it working? Why isn't it? Instead of inhibitory learning, you're doing the action, which is what you can control. Whether the anxiety drops or not is not necessarily important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's kind of where ACT comes in. That's where mindfulness comes in. That's where, honestly, I would say that almost any therapy, and I don't know if this is something that's been posited, I'm sure it's been posited by others, but in my mind, almost every form of therapy, be it, you know, on the far Freudian side of the spectrum or totally behaviorist, is really about establishing some sort of, whether it's called the independent observing self or the metacognitive self, or the gatekeeper or something like that, just being able to see the different kind of forces that are going on in your mind and have some autonomy over them, rather than different voices or narratives or cognitions or whatever you're going to label it, says jump and you say how high.
Mm. Yeah, good point. Okay, and when you when you're setting up ERP to one of your clients, are you talking in terms of habituation and inhibitory learning, or
I talk about both of them?
Yeah,
I think that it's good to know, because I think that most patients that come in are more familiar, even if they're not familiar with the words themselves. Most patients that I see are already pretty well educated in terms of ERP. Mm. They've done their research online, and I think a lot of the talk online and a lot of the information out there is more oriented towards helping understand it through the lens of habituation rather than inhibitory learning. Mm. So I could almost assume that my new patients have that degree of lens. So I think it's important certainly to mention. I think a firm understanding of both and knowing the limits of either or and which direction to orient in order to really understand the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law is really helpful for them.
Yeah. No, thank you. That makes sense. Yeah. And then this is probably just getting you to hypothesize. What do you think online, maybe the resources and the blogs talk more about, and maybe therapists talk more about habituation and inhibitory learning? Is it just that habituation has been around for much longer?
And therefore I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. To the best of my recollection, I was taught the habituation model in grad school. Mm. I don't know how much inhibitory learning was mentioned, even though I think it's important to note the research behind inhibitory learning. This is certainly not like a super new trend. This isn't like 5 years out there and not yet validated. It's 10, 20 years old, maybe even more than that. Mm. And there's a lot of research and articles about it, but I think that the community is just, you know, there's a slow process. There's a gap between empirically supported treatments or evidence-based or theory and clinicians practicing it.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Yeah, I was taught habituation as well and not inhibitory. Sure. I think it got mentioned on one of my courses, but not in any detail.
Yeah.
Cool. What other points have you got?
So we have, I love this term that Dr. Phillipson coined, which is the backdoor spike, which he might describe it a little more nuanced and in a specific way than me. But in my mind, I kind of expanded that concept to mean OCD about OCD treatment or OCD about OCD, right? I think that having a watchful eye for patients obsessing and compulsing about their OCD and obsessing and compulsing about the skill to which they're doing exposures is a really, really essential thing for someone specializing in EXRP to have an eye for that. It seems, based off of my patients' reports, that many clinicians miss, right? So what I mean by that a little more kind of specifically is a lot of times patients will be frequently, let's say during exposures, right? If this is not addressed, during the exposure, a patient might be constantly monitoring, okay, I think that my anxiety is supposed to go up when I'm doing this exposure. If my anxiety doesn't go up, I'm never going to get better and I'm going to have to deal with this forever. So I'm really going to try to make my anxiety go up. Oh my God, it's not going up, et cetera, et cetera. And they have kind of that anxiety about that. Or having OCD about their OCD. What if this isn't my OCD? Maybe my clinician misdiagnosed me. Maybe I'm just doing this to absolve myself of this guilt that I'm actually a terrible person. Both of these versions of OCD, or both of these themes of OCD, I think need to be treated first, even if a lot of times we establish a hierarchy, we work our way up, you know, what's your distress on the scale from 1 to 10, 10 being the highest. And okay, so let's start at the 2s or the 3s. Even if your fear that this isn't OCD, or your fear that you're not going to be able to do the exposures correctly is at, let's say, a 5 or a 6, it's rarely the top fear. I think unless it's done first, it interferes with the progress of any other exposures because you are compulsing while doing other exposures. And it makes treatment success very difficult to achieve.
Yeah, really good point. And how obvious is that for you or even the client that this is happening?
I think for the client, it's very rare that the client themselves would identify this, because it's a tricky one. It's meta, you know. It's we're already focused on learning that you could see your thoughts differently, which is a very novel concept for many people. That you could kind of think about your thoughts in different ways. That you could be skeptical of your thoughts even if they feel real. But to introduce a whole new level that you could think about your thoughts, right? Is trickier. It's trickier conceptually, but I think once you point it out and once you notice that it's happening, treating it is really no more difficult. It just means doing an extra step, but it doesn't take any significantly more time or more energy or more kind of tricky to do. But you do have to have an eye for it. In terms of having an eye for it, because I specialize in exposure response prevention and I've worked with probably hundreds of people at this point, you get to see a lot of patterns, and I think that I'm able to notice it fairly quickly. There's just kind of an energy behind compulsing, right? There's the pressured feeling that this is do or die if I don't kind of get this right or figure this out, then whatever catastrophe is going to happen, asking kind of repeated questions, things like that, that are kind of hallmark giveaways that there's some compulsing going on.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. It's definitely one I've seen a lot of people get caught on. Okay, cool. Yeah. You got any more on your list?
Yeah, I got two more.
Excellent.
So one of them is about treating symptoms, not the problem itself. So I would say that there's a portion of the population that I treat that have been through therapy that they have reported was successful. They've gone through the top of their hierarchy, but they feel like they're back at square one. Okay. The theme shifted. They went through a stressor in their life, and now they're compulsing, you know, as much as anyone compulses. Mm. One reason why I think that is most likely to happen is that a lot of times folks who go through exposure response prevention kind of play a game of whack-a-mole with it, where the lesson that they learn is more about how to craft an exposure and tolerate a specific manifestation of the OCD, rather than being able to see OCD for its similarities, not its differences. The similarities of different themes are always going to be that energy that I referred to earlier, that energy of if I do not do this, or if I do not figure this out, my entire life is going to be terrible. Something that makes an all or nothing variable out of a situation. Something that uses a ton of catastrophizing that you find yourself thinking about over and over, or, you know, compulsing. Mm. And being able to identify that energy in no matter what way it pops up, rather than falling for, well, the content is different, well, the words that it's using is different, well, this kernel of truth, you know, this tiny convincing bit of evidence behind it is different. I think it's a really, really important thing to internalize before leaving therapy. Mm-hmm. So I often say to my patients that I hope that their theme switches when we're working together, so that they have that opportunity to learn how to see the OCD for what it is, how to not get tricked when it switches forms, which it often does during successful therapy, right? Because it's a broken alarm system. It's just looking for justification. When you deny justification on one theme, it's very common to switch to another theme, for which I'm glad for. Frankly, when working with someone, so that they get that learning opportunity. And I think that, you know, not when that second theme comes around, not seeing it as a whole new version of OCD, but it's just your old OCD with this fake novelty mustache that it puts on and knocks at the door again and tries to sell you the same stuff. and being able to say, yeah, welcome back, you know, nice new outfit, but, you know, we're going to have the same relationship, is an important way to help increase the chances that you're going to have kind of longevity of the benefits that you get from it.
Yeah. So it sounds like relapse prevention is always inbuilt throughout the entire process of all the way through. We're doing it around harm, but what we're doing will equally work if you apply the same things we're learning together to contamination or religion or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. I often say to my patients that my goal is to be completely useless to them by the end of therapy, right? So that when they're off on the world, in the world, and if their OCD throws them a curveball, they know how to deal with it, even if it's been, you know, months or years since we've worked together.
Excellent. Yeah.
And then the last one, this is a little bit more of a nuanced one, but I've found that there are some pros and cons in terms of the language that one is using when they're doing exposures. Sometimes clients have come to me and said that exposure response prevention that they've been through was just a depressing experience to them, that they just experienced distress without the catharsis of learning how to deal with it. And there has been somewhat of a trend that the language that they've used hasn't incorporated signals of uncertainty in it. So let's say I have HOCD and my spike is, what if I'm gay, right? For some patients in previous therapies that they've been through, their exposure has been kind of, let's say, this mental exposure of, I'm gay, you know, now I have to figure out a new life now that I have this new identity, right? For some patients that I've worked with, they've actually preferred that language. It's felt like a more powerful reckoning with their distress. But I would say that the majority of patients that I work with experience more benefits if they're using, catching it in terms of uncertainty. I'll never know if I'm gay. Maybe I'm gay. There's always going to be the chance that I'm gay. And sometimes if they couch it in the more certain terms, they just experience depression from just facing what they have this subjective experience of, this must be true. This is my kind of nightmare come to reality. Or, you know, not that they would even consider that the nightmare, but the nightmare, you know, of having to change their identity, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's, and how often do you see that come up?
I would say that that's maybe less likely or less often than some of the other issues. I would say that the former issues are more predominant, but it's definitely something that I look out for, even in my own work. Sometimes I'll go over EXRP with someone and they'll go home and they'll do it and they'll come back and say, I didn't notice any change in my relationship to the thoughts. I just started to experience a lot of depression after doing so. And it's pretty often that that some of the language that they've been using is a primary culprit for that.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that is interesting. Thank you for sharing that. I really liked all that. That was your last point, right?
Yes.
Cool. You can have more if you want, but I just wanted to
that's sure. All.
Okay.
No other thoughts.
Good. Well, I had loads of questions, but they don't seem fitting now. And I really like how you've kind of set it up. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to ask a few other questions.
Sure.
I guess we've kind of addressed this, but on your website, it says quality therapy should change your life. I like this and I just wanted to get your opinion on it.
Yeah, I guess what I mean by that is going back to the first point that we've spoken about of folks that have what they report is such a frustrating experience of going to a therapist for years because they're told, you have challenges in your life, go to therapy, right? But there seems to be a lot of therapy out there that is built off of that model of just talking, right? Not built on kind of insight or understanding or things like that. And for some folks, that can be useful, but almost every time that I see somebody who has been in therapy 4 years, it is because they've been in it for, they've been in this version of therapy that has been kind of this rote discussion of things, sometimes circular and sometimes unhelpful. And it could lead to feeling defeated, to feeling like therapy doesn't work, that therefore there's no options for me. I think that good therapy should change your life and should change your life in ways that are concrete and observable to you, that you could mark, okay, my subjective experience of life is different this month than the month before it. Not every day, but I think month to month, you deserve to be able to experience some change from good therapy.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that view. Okay, so slightly different question is, how has your views of therapy or CBT, however you want to answer it, changed over the last few years, if it has?
That's a really interesting question. I need to take a second to think about it. I think over the course of my work, it's become less manualized, so to speak, and more clinical instinct kind of driven and interpersonally based. I had a very strong pressure to work at a very specific pace, in internalized pressure. This didn't come from anyone else. Okay. In fact, at some point I was questioned about it, but to work at a very specific pace, to say, okay, by the third session, I want to, have accomplished X or Y, et cetera, et cetera. And if they're coming in for OCD, OCD must be the most pressing thing in their lives. Let's just focus on that. The intake can be relatively brief because I'm just going to kind of trust them at their word and we'll jump right into the hierarchy, et cetera, et cetera. Over the course of my practice, I've definitely developed the understanding that people are more than just their OCD, that each case is unique, that each individual responds better to a different order of operations, some nuances and different styles, even in terms of language that we use or tools that we use, and develop the ability, which is far from perfected, but in the process of developing that ability, to work with each client to figure out how we can collaborate to make the best treatment plan for them.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, it's definitely some good growth.
Thank you.
And clinical instinct, I like that. Okay, so you can pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old Sam. What'd you tell him?
Oh boy, stick in there. Yeah, I mean, grad school is a grind, but I guess I speak with a lot of people and I work with a lot of clients to figure out how to most skillfully integrate their values into their day-to-day. A lot of times that doesn't directly involve their jobs, but their jobs is a means towards their values. You know, even if it's a prestigious job, you know, someone who works for Amazon or whatever, that's not necessarily their values, but, you know, maybe it gives them time to, you know, have money to donate to charitable causes, et cetera, et cetera. I think I'm lucky in that I've found a job where my job is my value. I think different points during my development through that career, it's been difficult. And what clinician does not wonder, you know, am I really cut out for this? But I think that's why I would say stick in there. I think I've landed in a very lucky place.
Excellent. Yeah. Good advice to all trainees too. Yeah. Okay, so you got a billboard in New York or New Jersey. What do you want written on that billboard?
Oh goodness, I would. I mean, my one of my greatest wishes is that even in the school system, folks can have just one class where they learn that they don't have to respect their thoughts, that their brain can produce things that are not necessarily important or that are not necessarily true, and that that's okay. I think that, you know, so much of my job is providing psychoeducation that I wish was just standard. That so many people wouldn't suffer as much knowing that they're not alone in this struggle. And that what they're experiencing is just a version of what every human being experiences. So much of suffering is done alone when it's such a global experience, or, you know, such a frequent experience. So I don't know if that you know, monologue could be fit into a billboard, you know, but you know, it would certainly be something along the lines of that. You know, not as rote as, or overused as you're not alone, but, you know, just that, you know, your brain can do whatever it wants and you can do whatever you want. And those two things don't have to conflict.
Absolutely. I can agree more. I think it should be in school systems.
Yeah.
I'm sure it will be eventually, hopefully. Yeah, who knows. Okay, and then lastly, is there anything else you wish you could have shared today?
That I wish I could have shared? I really appreciate that you have this platform. I know that it's changed so many people's lives, really. I mean, the only way that I know about OCD stories is because of the countless patients that I've worked with that have said that this podcast specifically had really opened their eyes as to, you know, what treatments are available or tips and tricks to finding a clinician or what makes, you know, effective therapy or not. So I'm just really grateful to you. And I think, you know, I know that a lot of the OCD community is really grateful to you as well for even just having this platform and for sticking with it for such a long period of time.
Yeah, it means a lot. Well, thank you for sharing, and to all your clients that listened. Yeah. And yeah, thank you for, you know, you've now contributed to it. So thank you for your time today.
My total pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
So there you have it. Thank you, as always, to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it, and I hope it's helped you. And thank you to Sam for his time. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.